أقرب من البرلمان. As you would remember, we had an acting chairperson from for the committee, and I've been advised that today we should elect a full-time chairperson for the committee in terms of Rule 129 of the NA rules. So I will open the floor for nomination. Honorable Jeffrey. Honorable, can you just second formally for the people?
I second Mr. Landers as Honorable Chairperson of the Justice and Constitutional Development, commencing immediately, having served on the committee with him for 12 years.
do we have any further nominations? Honorable Jeffrey, you are the only one. We have got one nomination from you. In the absence of any further nominations, can I maybe then call upon Honorable Landers to come and take his chair?
Very well with you, and I hope when I'm in justice, you'll always apologize for me because you understand what is going on. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, you bring to this committee a wealth of experience and a great sense of equanimity, which are the requirement for a justice committee. So also on my personal behalf and I'm sure on behalf of my party, congratulations.
Sir President, in case my name doesn't appear in the record. Unless I'm misunderstood, it's not to be in favor of your election. You accept my congratulations as well.
I'm given to understand, honourable members, that you've received a document or documents, three of them, and these documents will help guide us in today's deliberations. I take it that Advocate Dilanga, you and your team will help us in this exercise.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yes, and if I briefly may just introduce them, it's Mr. Solo Roberts, who's the principal person from the department side who dealt with the bill. Mr. Lynn Clark is from the South African Law Reform Commission. She's done many years of research, and that they produced the report that eventually resulted in the bill. I must apologize on behalf of Mr. Bassett, Chair, who really was a lead figure in this. He's unfortunately experiencing some medical challenges at the moment, and he will be out for a while. I must also just alert you to the fact that I've not personally dealt with this, but I am here to assist you. Also, there's another committee in the NCLP, but I don't think that will affect you or me, but I may have to pop out at some stage. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. The department was requested to respond to comment that was discussed in the committee, and also previously certain questions that was asked in the committee regarding the bill. There's two documents, actually three documents that was handed out. The department intends firstly to deal with the written comments received by the committee on the bill. Secondly, also to deal with the questions that was asked in the committee regarding the bill. And the third document is a proposed amendment to the bill. So I will proceed. Okay, first comment in general on the bill. The University of Witwatersrand actually supported the bill. The South African National Editors Forum and Print Media South Africa gave the following comments on the bill. Firstly, that they are alarmed at the increase of the number of bills and other instruments which contains restriction on media in addition to those they perceive in the Protection from Harassment Bill. Furthermore, neither SANEF or PM, I'll refer to them as SANEF to cover both groups. I said that they were not consulted on the proposed bill at any stage prior to its publication on 8 May 2009. And they said that the media should have been consulted before submission of the bill to Parliament. And they say that they are prejudiced by having little over a month to comment on the bill, given the fact that other interested groups...
Yeah, sorry, do you have any tissues? No, I was meaning more that it's such a sob story coming from SANEF that I thought we might want to distribute some tissues. Sorry.
What a cavalier attitude to the freedom, towards the freedom of the press.
Okay, I'll continue. I'll then, in relation to the response, that they were actually prejudiced and they did not receive
enough time to comment on the bill. It must be pointed out that the South African Law Reform Commission publicly requested comment on the issue paper on stalking in 2003 and on the discussion paper on stalking in 2004. Numerous reports and various publications reflect engagement with individual journalists. The South African Law Reform Commission actively engaged with the public at all stages of its investigation. All its documents are placed in the public arena by way of a press statement. Example, SAPA, South African Law Commission, issue paper on stalking, 28 August 2003, available on www.allafrica.com. An open invitation is issued to all interested parties to engage with the South African Law Reform Commission on the contents of its issue and discussion papers and during its workshop on these documents. Besides reporting on the content of the investigation, the media did not make a submission to the South African Law Reform Commission or raise concerns relating to the effect of the proposed legislation on its work. The bill as amended by the Department of Justice was again published for public comment in 2009, to be more precise, I think it was in May 2009, and at this point SANAF made submissions to the Department of Justice, and these submissions were considered in finalizing the bill. The third response from SANAF is that a bill is mainly welcomed as improving on the legal protection available to stalking victims, and that it closes a gap in the law that left stalking victims not in a domestic relationship with the perpetrator unprotected. They further said that the bill may have unintended consequences which are likely to affect the media in carrying out its vital role as the eyes and ears of the societies. The unintended consequences of the bill will be later discussed when we deal with the definition of harassment. Okay, Triangle Project is the third submission discussed, and they agree with the broad aims of the bill, which adequately address the gap in legislation available to victims of harassment outside the context of a domestic relationship, and which address stalking within the broader concept of harassment. The provision of the bill are specific and provide for remedy outside the current civil and criminal law. The remedy proposed by the bill may also have the effect that matters may be finalized quicker than criminal and civil remedies currently available. They further respond to the bill as follows, that discrimination and inequality should not be confined only to the legislation that explicitly concerned with promoting equality and prohibiting discrimination, that should be included in all relevant legislation. The response thereto is that legislation dealing with discrimination and equality has its own field of application, namely provides for the prohibition of and to provide remedies for discrimination and inequalities. It will be very difficult and impractical to specifically address these aspects in other legislation. With specific reference to the bill, all types of harassment are prohibited if it causes harm, irrespective of the fact that the harassing act was done with a discriminatory objective, an inequality objective, a sadistic object, or any other objective. The third response was the harassment legislation should ensure that marginalized groups are not hampered by discrimination and prejudice of the police and court officials who are responsible for implementing the legislation. The response is that it is not necessary to provide for these aspects in the law. It is a constitutional imperative that all persons be treated equally and that no person may discriminate unfairly against another. In any event, legislation adopted in terms of Section 9 of the Constitution, namely the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Undiscrimination Act 2000, gives practical effect to the right to equality and may be used to address these concerns. Further response from them is that it is necessary that the bill should give more consideration to Section 9 of the Constitution, by explicitly including harassment based on discrimination and prejudice based on sexual orientation, gender and gender identity, race, nationality, socioeconomic status, class, religion, age, disability, and health status. It is also suggested that the definition of harassment contained in the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act be incorporated in the definition of harassment. The response thereto is that I think we already dealt with that previously, in the previous answer that was provided. The further response was that a monitoring mechanism should be put in place to monitor harassment cases in general or based on discriminatory grounds. The response is that statistics on application of the bill will be kept by the department. However, it will be impractical to monitor the specific facts in each case in order to determine the underlying motive of the harassment. Okay, now move to the response from the Women's Legal and Rural Education Awareness Committee Health. I will refer to them as in future as WLC. They support the general purpose of the bill, and it is submitted that a bill may also help to prevent harassment of sex workers. Okay, Avusa also made a submission in general on the bill. And they say that although the bill are supported and there is a need that this area of the South African law needs to be reformed in order to protect the victims of stalking, the Bill Act may have unintended consequences of curtailing investigative reporting on matters of public concern, which will result in infringement of rights to freedom of expression and may be used against journalists who legitimately and in good faith are pursuing a story of public interest. It is admitted that if a journalist acting in his or her professional capacity exceed the bounds of reasonableness in gathering the facts for a story, that already provides for remedies. For example, the right to privacy, the civil and criminal sanctions available through crime and jury and possible trespassing, and an interdict where the victims fear harm or the violation of his or her rights. Furthermore, the vast majority of newspapers are bound by the press code and broadcasters by the Broadcasting Complaints Commission of South Africa's code, which police ethical breaches by journalists, including in relation to news gathering. I'll again deal with this later on when we discuss the definition of harassment. The Center for Constitutional Rights made the following submission in this regard, that although the bill may pass constitutional muster, the concern is raised that the bill might have negative implication on the right to freedom of expression, and request that this right be expressly included in the bill's preamble. Again, I will discuss this whole argument later on under the heading of harassment. Women's Net and the Commission for Gender Equality supports the bill. The South African Catholic Bishops' Conference support the bill, and they further say that in many difficulties in both the implementation and enforcement of the Domestic Violence Act suggest that there is a need for training of members of the South African Police Service and officers of the court. The response thereto is that due to the similarity of the bill with the Domestic Violence Act, it is admitted that minimum training for magistrates will be required regarding procedural aspects. This should also apply to clerks of the court. Justice College has indicated that it does provide extensive training on a centralized and decentralized basis to magistrates and clerks of the court on matters relating to the Domestic Violence Act. Justice College further indicated that training on the bill will be included in such training due to the similarity of the respective legislation with minimal cost implications, and will be covered by the existing budgetary framework of the department. It can be assumed that the South African police will employ a similar strategy in terms of training. Okay, next heading relates to the preamble and non-title of the bill. SANEF made the following submission. The bill may have unintended consequences which are likely to affect the media in carrying out its vital role as the ears and I as a society. In this regard, the preamble of the bill takes cognizance of the constitutional rights to equality, privacy, dignity, freedom and security of the person, and the rights of children to have their best interests considered to be of paramount importance. There is no reference in the preamble to the right to freedom of expression, including the freedom of the press and other media, and the freedom to receive or impart information or ideas. And they say that this is a curious oversight, given that the prohibition of harassment, which formed the cornerstone of the bill, is a limitation per se of the freedom to impart information, at least with regard to harassment by communication. And they suggest that this omission has the effect that drafters have not engaged in the necessary balancing of rights exercise in the limitations clause analysis with respect to the impact of the bill on the right to freedom of expression. And they suggest that a preamble of the bill should be amended to make reference to the right to freedom of expression, particularly the freedom of the press and other media, and the freedom to receive or impart information or ideas. The response of the department to this is that the purpose of a preamble is to give a general overview of the aims of the Act. The preamble of the Act is regarded as a secondary aid in the interpretation of statutes. This rule is stated as follows in Calloway, Principles of Legal Interpretation, 1995. The preamble cannot be used when the enacting clause is clear and plain. However, where the words are plain and unambiguous in themselves, uncertainty as to their meaning may arise from another source, and in such circumstances the preamble may be referred to as part of the context of the Act. It is admitted that it is not necessary to include the proposed suggestion in the preamble. See in this regard, Section 39 of the Constitution, which states that when interpreting any legislation, every court must promote the spirit, purport, and objects of the Bill of Rights. A court will ipso facto have regard to all the rights that may be applicable to a specific dispute. See in this regard, Hoxton v. President of the Republic of South Africa, 2002 Constitutional Court judgment, in which it was said that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It is unnecessary for legislation expressly to incorporate terms of the Constitution. All legislation must be read subject thereto. As it stands, the preamble is framed to acknowledge the right of victims. Other constitutional rights are not excluded from consideration, by virtue of not being expressed in name. However, the inclusion of the right of freedom of expression could be considered, but we regard it as not necessary. So you can just support it, please.
Just a point of order. Is it useful for us to be read? Shouldn't we just give ourselves a few minutes to read ourselves? We can go much faster, and then we can engage. I think that we all know how to read, and if we don't, we shouldn't be here.
Summarize it maybe a little bit. You don't have to read the whole thing, perhaps. Maybe to summarize the points, and because I don't think we all have had a chance to read this.
I know that's a problem I have. I haven't read this. I'm only seeing it for the first time now. But try your best, Mr.
Chair, then also, are we going to discuss, what point are we going to discuss, or are we going to have it read through the whole way? Wouldn't it be better as we get to each section so that there be some discussion if need be?
Okay.
For example, on the SANEP issue, I did want to raise that I was quite unhappy with the hearing that when the SANEP presented, both SANEP and Avusa, that the news reports only covered their input. So the issue of the comments and the responses from the committee were not covered in the input. which I just thought was appalling journalism. When I raised that with journalists, I was told no. When we got to discuss the bill, they would then cover it. I don't know which journalists are here now. But I think that the, for me, it was covered in the beginning, the SANEF complaints that they were not consulted were really off the wall. I mean, everybody had the opportunity. There's no special case for SANEF. If those that were present in the hearing would remember, I'd asked the Secretary of SANEF, Gay Davis, were they wanting like a special provision like with the House of Traditional Leaders that bills affecting the media? And I think that there is. I mean, it so happened that around that time, I don't know if you remember that case of that father who gassed himself and his two kids. And I ended up sort of coming into contact with one of the relatives who was complaining how thoughtless the media were, that they were just going round to the house wanting to photograph things. So I think definitely, you know, we don't, obviously there needs to be freedom of the press, but the media are not above the law and rights of common decency. I found it interesting yesterday on the TV with this case of this British-Swedish woman that was killed in Gugulethu, that you know, the magistrate specifically ordered no photographs of the accused to appear. And I mean, there were journalists climbing trees to try and get photographs of them as they went into court. So I think that we do need that. For me, the Abusa submission, and I think we'll get onto it when we get into greater detail, was something that needs to be looked at. But the SANEF one was really off the wall.
Mr. Chairman, are you entertaining comments on this specific issue, which I think would be worthwhile to be commented on?
Well, we're dealing with the bill in general.
No, on this, if we take one bite at a time on the SANEF issue.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like to offer a comment with two premises for me. The first is an apology. My attendance to the work of this committee has been intermittent because of my engagement on the secrecy bill. The second is that my comment on these occasions and whenever else I'm going to have an opportunity of speaking arise out of a concern, and that of not having fully identified the need for this legislation. And I think we should identify amongst ourselves very clearly, because we are legislating within the dynamic of social society. We're trying to change behavior. We have a host of legislative pieces in place in respect of domestic violence, harassment in the workplace, etc. And I accept the need for what is narrowly defined as stalking. But the definition of harassment, which is used here, is much, much wider. And that, against the background, the issue of the press. Whenever one studies, takes a book on the freedom of the press, the first chapter, the first thing that one learns is about the chilling effect. Whenever dealing with media freedom, one avoids having any action which can impair the freedom of the press, not specifically for what is written in legislation, but because of what is perceived. If a journalist is afraid of consequences, and somebody like me, who is often pursued by press, not as much as Mr. Jeffrey, but we have the possibility to say, we'll sue you, we'll call the police on you, then the journalist usually backs off, and that has a chilling effect. And on the balancing of interest, which one do we protect? If we were in the absence of any legislation, I would say on the balance of interest, we need to have that additional protection. But there being as much as there is, I would take this submission from SANEF very seriously, correctly or incorrectly as it may be, because it reflects the very type of mindset from which the chilling effect emerges. And I will make the point more adequately and repeatedly, that perhaps we need to have a smaller bill which again identifies the pain and addresses the pain, rather than having something which goes beyond what it is in the UK, beyond what it is in most of the United States. I mean, talking about California doesn't really help. California is a world of its own controlled by actors. I mean, and the rest of the country goes on with harassment laws as they are common law. But this may concern Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, I mean, I don't think we can dismiss concerns of Senate out of hand. I mean, whatever we may think of them. And I think once we get into the definition of harassment, which will come to later in the discussion on that, I think that will also come into, it will be a more useful place to really continue the discussion. I don't think we can really have it completely now until that aspect is dealt with. But I do think they make some valid points about public interest defenses and so on, which maybe we should consider.
The point I was going to make is, I mean, just following largely from Dr. Ambrosini, I mean, this bill is about protection orders. So the right to persons who feel they are being harassed to apply to court for a protection order. So it doesn't per se stop any activity, including any activity by a journalist. So they don't have to be frightened that if they do something, they're going to get into trouble. The worst that can happen to them is that they can get a protection order. The court can grant a protection order against them. That's all. And only then does it become criminal conduct if they continue. So I'm not quite sure what the chilling effect of this bill is. And, yeah, as I said, I mean, for me, I thought the SANEF submission was an embarrassment. I think the Abusa submission has merit that should be looked at, and really the any issues that SANEF raised that were of any relevance were raised by Abusa, and we'd be better off looking at that submission.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, I'm just worried quietly here. You know, when I think of the big concern about the freedom of the media, coming from a rural area where many of the women are not even able to read or buy a newspaper, the freedom of expression of the rural women are not a concern to us. It's about the freedom of the media, which are, you know, usually the elite, the people who can buy and read newspapers, the people who can communicate on their cell phones. And I would like to appeal that when we talk about the freedom of expression of South Africans, we also consider those people who are quiet, not out of their own choice, but because they have no access to be heard by the world. Because the world is listening to a few people who can really afford, who can work, who can earn, who can speak English. So in the rural areas, those people do have their own ideas, but it seems we are being left out as rural women. Thank you.
Maybe also, Chairperson, on the question of the order, I would think that the press will be having a right to apply that the order be set aside if they have a strong case to say that it prohibits them from carrying on with their normal activities.
Quite obviously, all these matters are going to be decided by the courts, not by you and me, fortunately. So, in as much as the person who claims to be harassed has access to the courts, so too does the media. They're not in any way prevented from challenging any orders of the court. But Mr. Roberts, we're still in your hands.
Thank you, Jefferson. Okay, what I will do in presenting the presentation, I will concentrate on certain key issues. Mainly the submissions made to the committee by the press relating to the bill, and mainly the definition of harassment. Further, that they actually allege that we, through the definition of harassment and the contravention of the protection order, we're actually creating strict liability.
And a further thing that's very important in this aspect is how do we deal with cyber stalking. I'm going to concentrate on that issue. The other issues has been summarized and there's comprehensive responses to them. And at the end of discussing that issues, and if the committee will, we can go ahead and try to address the other issues. I guess to start then, I will discuss the submissions of the press. It's being dealt with under the heading of definitions of harassment. It starts on page 6, continues on page 7 and further on. I think it's quite relevant in this regard that we carefully look at the arguments which has been summarized in the submission of the department. I'll read that out though. The first submission is that of SANEF, and they say that an overbroad definition of harassment puts journalists engaged in legitimate news gathering activities at risk of arrest or imprisonment. The bona fide activities of journalists should not be lumped in with the modern field activities of stalkers that it will prescribe. Self-regulatory structures, the Press Council and Broadcasting Complaints Commission and Codes of Conduct already ensured ethical journalism. It is then suggested that the following may be done to mitigate the risk to journalists as a result of this overbroad definition of harassment, namely, a public interest defense can be introduced, which may be mirrored in the relevant codes to ensure uniformity in the standards of behavior of, that is expected from the media. Furthermore, a new defense could be introduced in the bill based on the special characteristics of the media activities, and also that the media may be exempted from the bill, which may, however, have an unsatisfactory effect. Because it may help to pave the way for a media licensing system. And then they further discuss this and they say the exemption in the bill for conduct which is not unreasonable may prove inadequate protection for investigative journalists whose profession often requires them to push the envelope. If these activities are deemed unreasonable, the fact that journalists are in pursuit of a legitimate public interest object will not be enough to escape from being caught in a harassment net. And they say that should the bill be enacted without change, portions of the bill may unreasonably and unjustifiably be held to infringe the right to freedom of expression, in particular the freedom of the press and other media, and freedom to receive or impart information or ideas. Since we dealt with both SANEF's representation or VUSA's representation in one response, I'll read out the summary of the representations.
So I was just about to suggest, I think it might be easier for members, because everything here is focused now on the definition of harassment. It's not a long definition. Maybe it would be good if you just go through and read that definition and then we all understand what these people are commenting on.
Take a moment to do that, Mr. Roberts. Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, harassment. The bill actually defines harassment as follows. It means directly or indirectly engaging in conduct that causes harm or inspires a reasonable harm, a reasonable belief that harm may be caused to the complainant or related person by unreasonably, firstly, A, following, watching, pursuing or accosting the complainant or related person, or loitering outside or near the building or place where the complainant or related person resides, works, carries on business, studies, or happens to be. B, engaging in verbal, electronic, or any other communications aimed at the complainant or related person by any means, whether or not conversation ensues, or sending, delivering, or causing the delivery of letters, telegrams, packages, facsimiles, electronic mail or other objects to the complainant or related person, or leaving it where it will be fined by or given to or brought to the attention of the complainant or related person. Okay. The other definition that goes hand in hand with harassment is the definition of harm. And harm is defined as to mean any mental, psychological, physical, or economical harm. So the responses from SANEF was aimed at the broadness of this definition. I already dealt with that with SANEF, then I'll go over to the response from AVUSA. And they said, in general, that a bill may have the unintended consequences of preparing investigative reporting on matters of public interest, which will result in infringement of rights to freedom of expression and may be used against journalists who legitimately and good faith are producing a story of public interest. It is submitted that if a journalist acting in his or her professional capacity exceeds the bounds of reasonableness and gathering facts for a story, the law already provides remedies, for example, a right to privacy, civil and criminal sanctions that's available, namely time in jury and possibly a trespass and probably an interdict. And they said that the vast majority of newspapers are bound by the press code and broadcasters by the Broadcasting Complaints Commission of South Africa's code, which police ethical breaches by journalists in gathering news. With specific reference to the definition of harassment, they said that a broad definition of harassment and the mechanics of the act may be used to curb legitimate publishing and also gathering of news by journalists. According to them, if a person deliberately seeks to avoid journalists who persist in attempting to contact the person must seek a protection order in terms of the bill. Published newspaper articles that expose a person for committing a crime may be regarded as harassment. And they say that the mechanisms of the bill are such that a complainant could approach the court with no notice to the journalist, and if he or she makes out a prima facie case, he or she may obtain a protection order, which may stop news gathering activities. According to them, the court would typically not have the opportunity at that stage to weigh the evidence against the evidence that a journalist might present, particularly as to whether the conduct is reasonable or unreasonable. Furthermore, they say that even if the journalist overturned the order on the return day, the story will have been delayed, and this may create a chilling effect on the publication of certain stories. And they said that it is admitted it was not the intention of the bill to frustrate legitimate news gathering activities, and therefore the bill should be amended to allow these activities. And then they say that the definition of harassment implies strict liability. In other words, although the section requires the belief of the complainant to be reasonable, there is no requirement of either intent or negligence regarding the respondent. And they then propose certain amendments to the bill, which is set out here, and I'm not going to read that. Okay, our response to that is the following. We said that no distinction should be drawn between the conduct of a journalist and that of other persons or entities. The question may well be raised why the conduct of a journalist should be raised above the standard of reasonableness versus other persons or entities. In the definition of harassment, the crux of the definition is that if certain conduct is unreasonable, it will amount to harassment. If it's in general reasonable, it will not amount to harassment. And we leave it in the hands of the court to determine whether certain conduct is either reasonable or unreasonable. I
then refer to example here, it's either that of a police officer, which actually question or otherwise harass a person by following him around, making phone calls, sending emails, SMS in order to force the person to divulge certain information about crime that has been committed. And I, with reference to journalists, one may argue that this conduct of the police officer is definitely in public interest, well, probably more so than that of a journalist, in that they may lead to the solving of crime. But then, if you look at the current law, this conduct of a police officer is actually frowned upon by the courts. You can look at the authorities quoted there and the legislation quoted there, which actually prohibits such conduct. In the example that was written down, which I present to the committee, it is the standard, the Boney Morris, the standard of a reasonable person, or the the feelings of the community that it takes, that a right of individual should rather be protected over whatever may be gained in public interest if it infringes on the vested or constitutional intense rights of such an individual. Okay, in this exercise, various constitutional rights may be relevant here. For instance, the right to freedom of expression, the right to freedom of security of the person, the right to privacy, and the right to dignity, which all need to be balanced. The most appropriate step was to introduce a procedure through which these conflicting rights could be judged and measured in relation to each other. Of particular importance here is the Constitutional Court case, filed versus Makwanyane, which deal with the principle of proportionality. I'm not going to read out the whole quote, but in the case it was said that there is no absolute standard which can be laid down for determining reasonableness and necessity. Principles can be established, but application of those principles to particular circumstances can only be done on a case-by-case basis. This is inherent in the requirement of proportionality, which call for a balancing of different interests. In the balancing process, the relevant considerations will include the nature of the right and its limit and its importance to an open and democratic society based on freedom and equality. Okay, I'm not going to go further, read that further. Okay, then we said the procedure which was decided upon was to subject these competing rights, journalists and other people, to judicial scrutiny. A particular feature of the definition of harassment is that conduct complained of must be unreasonable. The effect thereof is that before a court can grant an interim or final protection order, the reasonableness of the action complained against must be considered in light of all the circumstances. This investigation may include the balancing of all these constitutional entrenched rights. In order for journalists to do their work, it can be accepted that they may have to call a particular person frequently, in some instances confront him or her with questions. In public, in some instances, even follow such a person. If this is done in a reasonable manner, a court may come to the conclusion that the conduct of a journalist complained about does not amount to harassment. However, it is easy to perceive instances and even refer to certain instances where journalists have overstepped the boundaries of reasonableness in order to get a story, and their behavior could, in those circumstances, be curtailed by way of a protection order against harassment in terms of the bill. The same will apply to industrial actions and protests. Okay, with specific reference to the proposals that was proposed by Avruza, the following will be relevant. To exempt the media from the bill, to give them a specific defense, may well have the effect that a carte blanche is given to media to harass at will without affording the victim of such harassment any recourse in terms of this bill. With specific reference to the amendment proposed by Avruza and the exclusionary grant, you can see that it is unlimited.
If a journalist actually falls within that exclusionary grant, he can never be, his conduct can never amount to harassment, even though it might otherwise be regarded as harassment, or even a delict, or even a crime. And it is acknowledged that the current position is that if the media exceeds the bounds of reasonableness in gathering facts for a story, the law already provides remedies in civil and criminal law, inter alia delictual claims, interdicts, and prosecutions for criminal offences. In general, very few persons can, however, afford civil litigation, especially if the respondent, in this case the media, has unlimited resources. And in general, I believe criminal cases take much too long to provide any protection to a person if you want to make use of a criminal remedy. It must further be acknowledged, as has been pointed out by Vissa, that published news articles may be regarded as harassment in terms of the bill and may be prohibited by means of a protection order. The publication of a newspaper article is the same as any other conduct through which a person may be harassed. The question whether a news article relates to harassment or not depends on the reasonableness of the article and whether the article causes harm or inspires a reasonable belief that harm may be caused to the complainant. With reference to the comment that the mechanics of the bill are such that it may stop news gathering activities, the following should be considered. On the receipt of an interim protection order, the respondent, in this case the media, may in terms of clause 3.5 anticipate the return date by written notice to the complainant and the court. This will have the result that the proceedings regarding the consideration of the final protection order will be sped up and the validity of the harassment claims will be considered during a hearing. Furthermore, an interim protection order, like an interim interdict, is a temporary and exceptional remedy which is available before the real rights of the party are fully determined by a court of law. In general, the court should be cautious in their approach whether to grant an interim protection order. Interim relief granted by a court is not, in general, subject to appeal unless it is final in effect. You can look at the case of McSant, which is referred to in the submission. But then, in clause 14 of the bill, we make provision that all proceedings in terms of the bill are subject to appeal or review. It is thus admitted the respondent may take the interim protection order on appeal or review in certain circumstances.
That honourable members may want to have another careful look at Avusa's submissions and their comments arising from Mr. Roberts' analysis. Dr. Ambrosini.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The crack of this entire issue, that on which everything turns, is the concept of reasonableness. And I submit to you there is more reasonableness criteria that is reasonable to have. And I really suggest everyone to read a fascinating and very funny book called Uncommon Law, which is a collection of funny cases from the English jurisdiction. And the greatest chapter is about reasonableness. What's a reasonable man? What's a reasonableness? And what really hinges in common law is that in an English society you've got a common set of values, what the presenter refers to as the bona mores, the values within society. And they are stratified. They are the values of the upper class which are imposed on the lower class, and everyone lives with it. Certain things are not done. You cross the line. You are unreasonable. Now, that doesn't work in South Africa. This is a diverse society. My wife, who is from what she characterizes as conservative, polite Afrikanerdom, thinks that everything I do, everything I say is unreasonable. And she feels very strongly about it. She would file an harassment suit against me every other day. We've got different standards. And there are many people in South Africa who do things which I find appalling. But it's the way they express themselves, they live themselves, and we don't have something that we don't have that will, that we can throw the bucket down and we take the water of reasonableness out. So I'm very uncomfortable in these long expositions made in the court may say this, the court may say that, on the basis of reasonable, the balance, the reasonableness, the balance of interest, the taking into account of this against that and against something else, it's that which defines the freedom of press. And we're dealing with something which is very delicate, as well as the freedom of interpersonal relationships. And we're all in agreement that we need to do something to stop the ex-boyfriend harassing the ex-girlfriend, etc. But we are dealing with the flesh and bone of interpersonal relationships. So my plea is whether the Law Commission, the esteemed lawyers there, could not find something which is more clearly definable than bona social mores, bona mores of society, social conventions, as underpinning reasonableness.
Okay, so I just want to ask on the issue of, I mean, I accepted that you can anticipate the return data speed up the processes, but would it not maybe be worth considering allowing for, in the case of something like journalists, not having ex parte applications? They can just have a quicker form of notice than the normal and allow them to come immediately and state their case. Because you can say they can appeal and review and all that nonsense, but we know how long that takes to get done. Just, I would like your comments on this.
Mine is the English exclusions, you know, which some of which Bavusa have proposed for the purposes of preventing, if the conduct was for the purposes of preventing or detecting a crime. In particular, why? What's your response to that? I mean, so another jurisdiction actually has that in. Why then don't we?
I'll start with Mr. Abrasini's response first. If you look to the following response in the paper, I believe the reasonableness test is set out in full. And I believe, you know, reasonableness in South African law is a well-established principle. You get something like a reasonable time, a reasonable person, a reasonable man against which negligence is inter alia judged. It's an objective test in light of all the circumstances. In economic transaction, I accept it. There is a reasonable man in contractual things. Here, it's a new field. There is no jurisprudence on what is reasonable in pursuing an ex-girlfriend. This will all need to be developed. There is no jurisprudence in many of these aspects.
I might refer the Honourable Member Dr. Abrasini to various decided cases in South African law. A lot of these cases in Italia deal with criminal law. I think if you do a search about reasonable man, reasonable person, reasonable conduct, you'll probably come up with, well, hundreds of cases in which the general principle was applied. And the reason why we use the reasonable test is to make provision for, or rather to make provision for circumstances that is not foreseen, and also to provide for some leeway in matters. The moment when you define a certain thing on the statute book, you're bound to that. you will not be able to develop something outside the act or to interpret it otherwise that than that that is provided for in an act. You'll be stuck with that definition. And due to the fact that there may be various different circumstances that might come to a court in a case of harassment, I think it's absolutely necessary that you have some kind of bendable or malleable criteria against which you can actually determine or judge or take into account when you want to determine if certain conduct is acceptable or not. Regarding a quicker process, the next response, we can probably look at a quicker process, but then we actually make certain specific exceptions for entity or party, which is not afforded to anybody else. And I believe if you make a law, it must be something that is general applicable to all persons. And it will be a bit unfair to give the press a special status in this process.
Could we just following up on that, I mean, I accept that point, but is there any way we could maybe look at, not necessarily for the press as such, but in any context where the urgency of the publication or dissemination or whatever of the activity is such that it would be prejudiced if it were not done like that? Could it be maybe done in that way?
Well, can we consider it later on, Jefferson? We can look at it and against it. I think regarding the exclusionary rule, I think we, to an extent, we have addressed it in our submission. I refer you to page 9. In our submission, and they said that to exempt the media from the bill to give them a specific defense may well have the effect that the carte blanche is given to the media to harass at will without affording the victim of harassment any recourse in terms of the bill. The problem is usually that if it's a kind of blanket exemption, and the person actually falls within this blanket exemption, irrespective of how or what his conduct is. It may amount to gross harassment, but he falls within that exclusionary rule. Then you cannot regard that actions as harassment. And that is why we are against to provide for exclusionary rule.
Yeah, but I mean, you're missing the point. I mean, is a sensitivity around freedom of the media? You mentioned in your submission that there are existing laws that people actually can use against the media. So it then does become a question of why do we need this one? And another jurisdiction from which we inherit or use a lot of the provisions has this exclusion. So why? I mean, I understand, yes, it will give, I mean, and this exclusion is not for journalists, but it's basically if the intention is consistent with a particular area of public good, therefore, they then get excluded from this bill. So it's not journalists per se; it's people who are trying to prevent or detect a crime. So, you know, the point I hear what you're saying. Basically, in short, obviously, it then does allow people who have that objective in mind to greater leeway. But if another jurisdiction has put it in, why are we saying that it should be excluded.
If I may, the reason why exceptions weren't built into the proposed draft bill was because the defense, the common law defense of pursuance of a legal purpose is available right through to anyone who's faced with an application in terms of this bill. And if one looks at the UK legislation, there are three exemptions, and the one that's applicable to the media would be sub C, which is that in particular circumstances, the pursuit of the course of conduct was reasonable. It is included in our definition of harassment because we say that it may not be unreasonable. So they have to prove that their conduct is reasonable in terms of the exemption in their legislation. So if one looks at our definition of harassment,
That's why I haven't raised that last point, because I see the last point is covered by the fact that you've got to allege the conduct was unreasonable, so you don't need a defense about the conduct was reasonable. My point, though, is, and you've just raised it now, that it doesn't exclude the common law defense. How can you say that? I mean, statute changes the common law. And this statute provides that this common law defense still exists. It doesn't exist. So how can you substantiate why you came out with that statement?
Well, there's nothing that precludes them from using the justification that they were acting in legal purpose. It's before the court, and the court will decide whether the person has been harassed on that basis.
I just find this quite strange. This is statute, okay? That's a common law defense. Surely if one is going to be allowed to use that common law defense, it would have to be put in the statute. Not.
I just think that the common law defense gets through the door of reasonableness.
I can maybe explain. Let's take some of the common law offenses. They are something to the effect that I haven't got the intention. I know that's a bad thing, a bad example. Acting in self-defense, I think there is a very statute or something that prohibits a certain thing, but it does not address the common law defenses where you can say, or against the charge can utter the defense of the common law offense of I acted in self-defense. It's never dealt with in that. It's a defense that is always available.
Yeah, I think that's a bad example because, I mean, you use that for things like murder, for assault, which are effectively common law offenses. So it's a common law defense. Really what I'm saying is if the provision, and I'm not sure why Ms. Schaefer is saying that it doesn't preclude it. But if it is, then, okay, let's change the argument slightly. If that defense is already there and can be used, would it not make it easier for everybody concerned if that common law defense, if I'm wrong and you can use the common law defense, if we put that common law defense into the bill? Okay? I mean, your example of the intention is, as you said, is a very bad example because, I mean, mens rea is an essential element of any crime of any, yeah. So that's part of our law. But if there's a problem with, or if the common law defences can be used, why can't we put them in the bill and it'll be easier for everybody to read, including a magistrate?
Mr. Chairman, the Honourable Jeffrey has put a conceptual question, which I think is a valid one. So if we can try to address it not by way of example of anecdotes, to me the question, if I understand it correctly, is whether the concept of reasonableness would embody all the common law defenses, privileges, and exceptions. And I would see the difficulty of listing all those things because they go on and on and on. And I don't think there is a compendium out there made. I would guess, if that's the answer given, that the conceptual answer is that, in fact, the reasonableness is a door into the common law through which all these things come into the act, but if that's the answer.
So, sir, the reason I said what I said is that my understanding is that all defences apply unless they're excluded by statute. So if a statute is excluding a particular defence, then that will be excluded. You know, that does change the common law. But if it doesn't specifically exclude it, then it is available. And I would agree with Dr. Ambrosini on that score. Just on a lighter note, I must just say there is a substantial amount of doubt as to whether a reasonable man is actually something that exists.
In this book, Mr. Chernite will argue there is a reasonable man, but there is not such a thing as a reasonable woman. But it's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it to be read.
The period of 16 days of activism. Yeah, all right, Advocate DeLonga.
Gee, thanks, and if I might just add to that, then of course there's a presumption in interpretation of statutes that the legislature never amends the common law unless it's done expressly.
Chairman, the issue here is it's one of definitional. If we're dealing with territory definitions, then the common law is excluded. So if it is a defense cannot be used to change a definition, so what is defined as harassment would be such in spite of an existing defense, because the territory definition will override. But within the statutory definition, there is this big hole right in the middle, reasonableness. And that hole is that which would bring in all the rest, and which is set out in common law by limiting the definition itself to all that which is not reasonable, because the definition can be turned upside down, and all that which is unreasonable, all that which is reasonable is not harassment. Hence, all that which carries a defense, a privilege, and an exception is not harassment.
My problem as well with the unreasonableness is that it's the conduct has to be unreasonable. So the way you follow, watch, pursue, engage in verbal and electronic communication, send, deliver, whatever, that must be unreasonable. And so the British law thing comes from the other side of English law, of saying, okay, the pursuit of the course of conduct was reasonable. Now, the pursuit of the course of conduct, is that not the reason you were following the conduct, rather than the conduct itself? So, in other words, if the reason you were doing it was reasonable, that's then a defense in terms of English law, which has similar common law to us, and they saw fit to put it in the Act. Whereas the way our law is phrased is that the unreasonableness has to relate to the conduct, not the reason for the conduct. So I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but anyway, I'm thinking through it. I don't know why you're smiling, but yeah, okay. But am I correct in saying that the unreasonableness relates to the conduct? How you conduct yourself, not why you conduct yourself, how you conduct yourself. The English law,
the same intention.
Sorry?
Reason for what or why you actually do something like your intention behind the conduct. I think that is how you interpret the English law.
Yes. That in a particular, in the particular circumstances, the pursuit of the course of conduct was reasonable. So I'm interpreting that as the reason you follow that course of conduct. The pursuit was reasonable.
Well, I think
okay, which then does link to the intention, which is then separate to the South African.
Excuse me, if I may. If one looks at the actual offences, because the UK legislation has offences of harassment, what they actually define as an offence is that a person who pursues a course of conduct in breach of Section X, Y, and Z is guilty of an offence. So it really is just engaging in the conduct and not really the intent. But by virtue of engaging in the conduct, it's a breach. So it doesn't really relate to the intention, if I understand it correctly.
I want to ask you about your views on that intention thing, because I see the Abusa's suggestion is that they would like to see included respondent knows or ought to know that it's going to cause harm. What is the reason that you didn't want to put that in?
Well, I think it's dealt with somewhere in the submission. I need to get it, but as such, we came to the conclusion that in order to adequately address harassment, we must not make provision for intentional conduct. We can probably better explain this by reason of examples. Let's see, there's a person that's completely certifiable in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. He cannot form an intention to do, to commit a crime in the area, and obviously cannot form an intention to harass. Obviously, if we, that is probably one of the instances where you want to protect a complainant, where you actually want to protect a complainant due to the fact that will usually or may have quite severe consequences for the complainant. Furthermore, you get something, I think it's framed or called the delusional harasser, where I harass Mr. X while I think that I'm actually harassing Mr. Y. So I haven't got the intention to harass Mr. Y. Okay, there's lots of examples that I can go into.
Thank you, Chairperson. I see Mr. Ambrosini's, Honorable Ambrosini, has already run away because I really wanted him to withdraw the statement that he made. There's no unreasonable woman. That is very much unhonorable and I think unparliamentary. And I hope next time when he comes before we start, he should be given an opportunity to humbly apologize and withdraw. Thank you.
And will you ask Ms. Schaefer to do the same about us poor men? I thought it was being done in jest. Okay.
Chairperson, let me apologize on my question. It discloses a great deal of ignorance on my part. I've been looking at the purpose of the bill in the memoranda of the objects. And I see that among other purposes is to contribute to the fight against violence against women and children. And nobody would fault any effort in that direction. And it also refers to the need for the amendment of the Domestic Violence Act to ensure mechanisms, to provide for mechanisms to subpoena witnesses to attend proceedings in a violence matter. Now, I wonder why would it be necessary for that kind of an amendment to that act to be facilitated by this kind of bill of legislation, as well as the need to amend the Criminal Procedure Act to take into consideration matters relating to bail proceedings and to improve process of granting peace orders given by magistrates. In short, I'm trying to find out if what exactly prompted the Law Commission to want to come up with this kind of legislation. Are there no? Is there not enough legislation or law that could attend to these things, harassment? Because it's basically about harassment and stalking. Does it mean there's no law, there's no remedy in any law to resort to in order to prevent this kind of mischief? I've been struggling to establish my mind as to what really is the drove the Law Commission to do this. In short.
Well, the whole reason why the Law Commission actually investigated the matter was inter alia that there is no law that adequately cater for the protection against harassment. On the one hand, you get the Domestic Violence Act, which actually provides for inter alia stalking. You can get the interdict in terms of the Domestic Violence Act against stalking. The only problem is that the Domestic Violence Act is only applicable to persons that is something like a husband or a wife, a domestic relationship, I think that is the technical word for that. But outside that, there is no real law that addresses this. On the other hand, you can probably go to a court and ask for an interdict. The only problem is interdict is a very expensive remedy, and ordinary people at grassroots will most probably not afford such remedy. There is certain crimes. If the conduct actually amounts to a crime, you can they charge at the police station, and they will probably arrest the person and charge him for that crime. But in many instances, harassment does not amount to crime. That is on the statute book or a common law crime. So a person is actually without a remedy if that does not apply to you.
And even if that harassment amounts to harm of the kind and the state, it still doesn't amount to crime. I mean, even if the harm that we are talking about here is a result of that kind of harassment, it still does not amount to a crime.
Well, it might, let's say, amount to a delict. Okay, delict is on the one hand, you get a crime. If it's a crime that is on a statute book or that is a common law crime and enforced within the description of a crime, it might amount to a crime or a delict if it's civil in nature. But in various instances, through stalking, a person can be stalked through legitimate actions. Like I can probably send you flowers for, let's say, every day. Some people think it's nice, but the connotation there too is that some people, you may create a fear by another person. And to protect the person against these actions, it is necessary to introduce this remedy. Sorry, probably not flowers, but I can...
Chair, I think I've discovered the answer to my question around why we're not including the English law provision. And that is that then if the English law is creating crimes, it's obviously natural that you need defences. We're not creating crimes. So I think that's the significant difference. But it would be useful to get a copy of the English law. I mean, there is some reference to it in your other document, but it would be useful to get a copy of that. But I think that's significant. But the other point I wanted to raise is I don't have a copy of Professor Milo's presentation to the committee. But from what I remember, is he came up with some different proposals in his oral presentation to the committee, the overhead thingy, than he actually had in his submission. And I don't have a copy of that, but I think those were more, I mean, I think he was accepting that, that I think he'd raised, because it was short notice, the oral submission, sorry, the written submission was put together quite quickly, and in the intervening time between making the written submission and his presentation to the committee, he came up with new proposals. Now, can we, does anyone have a copy of that? And I haven't, you're only responding to his written submission, but there was a new submission made before the committee, which I think was more interesting than the written one.
Look, quite obviously, a lot of the success of the bill will hinge on our definition of harassment, and I deliberately use the word our because it's our responsibility. So Vonani confirms what Mr. Jeffries just told us, that there is Darius Milo's submission, and I think he's going to dig it up, so we'll make it available to all and we'll see whether that can take it forward. I assume, Mr. Jeffrey, you're saying that that helps in some way to assisting us.
No, I just thought it was a more refined aspect which would warrant a response. I understand now and support they're not including the British law provisions because we're not creating a crime, and those would be defences for a crime which you would need to do. But then there were, I think, some other elements of what he'd raised, but I can't remember what they were.
Chief, I may, just from my own rough notes on that day, he suggested three options, and this is not the refined one that he gave, but what he asked was to require intent to harass, or harassment means knowingly engaging in conduct which causes harm, or a lawful excuse defense, where harassment is not present where there is a lawful entitlement to act.
Okay. On another angle, I'm thinking of, for example, that maybe the mischief or the evil that we are trying to legislate against is, take for example a situation of a person, maybe on a daily basis, you wake up from your home, or when you go to work, you see this person has been walking behind you, has been following you. He's an unknown person you're not related to. And when you knock off, you find this person at your exit and the like, and is using the same road that you are using back home. And maybe take another example, a car, you are driving at 80 kilometers per hour. You see, there is a red car behind me. You drive at 150, this car is still behind me. You reduce the speed to 60, it doesn't overtake you. And then you go to the police station. You say, on a daily basis, this man is walking behind me to and fro work. Or this car is being driving behind me. The police will say, but what offense, what crime is committed?
Yeah,
they will say, no. We can't go and arrest that person. Or if that person is confronted, he says, no, it's a public road that I'm using. Why am I not supposed to be using that road? But you say, no, this man is behind, has been really tailing me and the like. And then, you know, my principal gave me an example, but it's sort of with respect to Stone. So that's it. My principal was Mr. Harvard Ferreira. He said, he calls me Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones, money to let that amendment of your heart rain. For don't allow a person to be continuously driving behind you. Either you've got also maybe to drive on the pathway, on the pavement to let him pass, you see. It's a question of a person who is either harassing you, or if a person says, I will get you, and then you go to the police and say, this one says it's going to get me, you say it's not is not an offense, but I think the proposed legislation is to cover such situations, to say a person who's busy pestering you, busy harassing you, there should be a legislation where you can say he has committed an offense or you apply for a court order. That's why I look at it, Chairperson, probably. Yes. Yes, it's harassment.
No, it then goes on to, I then just wanted to go on to the other angle of the knows or ought to know or knowingly causes harm or inspires the reasonable belief that harm may be caused, in that what happens in a situation of similar to Mr. Sipagnoni, loitering outside of or near the building or place where the complainant or related person resides, works, carries on business, studies, happens to be, and that actually happens to be where you work, carry on business, whatever. So how do you, shouldn't that the aspect of intention, having the aspect of intention would then exclude that situation where you just so happen to be regularly in the same area, the complainant thinks they're being harassed, but in fact you work in the building, so you hang around there as well.
I believe one of the elements of harassment is that a reasonable belief must be created. This again is something that will be decided by the court in all relevant circumstances. If one requires intention, let's say, for harassment, it will be almost impossible for a complainant to apply for an interdict due to the fact that when she applies for interdict, she will have to prove that you intentionally harass a person, and that is going to be very problematic. So that is why we decided in Tanya to leave the intention requirement out. I think I already dealt with that, why we do not actually require intention.
I know it would make it more difficult, but surely the intention is easier to prove if you are perpetually being accosted, watched by this person. You see, it's the watching, accosting, that's easier. The grey area would be the following, loitering, and there you could have considerable misunderstandings.
The suggestion is, it's a grey area, like you said. The court will look at all the circumstances. Remember, a reasonable belief. On the first hand, if harm is being caused, there's no problem. Then it's obviously harassment.
Yeah, but remember, we're dealing with magistrates.
Yeah. Mr. Jeffrey, the big problem is that we can probably look at it and maybe try to spell it further out, but really it's going to be problematic. We actually did look at intention at some stage, at least when the department was in possession of the bill and evaluated the comments of the South African Law Reform Commission, and various arguments were made out at that stage why we should not include
intentional conduct in the definition. But we can probably relook it, but really, we extensively investigated the matter.
You may have extensively, but we are passing this bill, so you need to convince us with respect.
Okay, in that instance, I believe the court will actually look at all the conduct and it's either where a person follow other person around. The court will decide in light of all the circumstances whether a reasonable person will come to the conclusion that this person is being harassed. I think that is the final verdict that the court will make out. If a person, let's say, follow it two or three times, I think a reasonable court may come to the conclusion that it's not a reasonable belief. But if a person, let's say, follow around for 5 days consecutively, maybe a local court will come to the conclusion that that belief is reasonable, and he may grant the requested relief. If a person had at that stage, if intention was inquired during your application for harassment order, a person, let's say, can grossly harass you. You can actually come to your house, drop off a letter, maybe do a lot of other actions into area, maybe kicking around your pit or something to that effect. And if you apply to court, one of the requirements the court will have to have in his possession is whether this person actually intentionally did harassing acts. In certain circumstances, that can be inferred from the conduct of a person. You can probably infer intention in some instances, but in some instances, it will be impossible to infer any intention. So, rather to protect the rights of vulnerable groups, we actually opted for the situation where we do not require intention.
My worry is I can just see the example of, and I think it's possible. You get somebody who thinks they're being harassed by their neighbor, and they run off to court. I mean, and remember, it's an ex parte application, so although there's a return date, the respondent has got no right to defend themselves the first time round, and the complainant alleges that this person is loitering around, but in fact they've got good reason. So it's the loitering, it's basically the conduct which does not necessarily link directly to the complainant. So it would be the following. The loitering aspect, and you could end up in a situation of a neighborhood dispute in a block of flats, and the people live near each other. The complainant goes off to court, gets a protection order that her neighbor, although she doesn't tell the court, his or her neighbor is harassing his or her, and then gets a protection order. And there are consequences once a protection order, even an interim one, is granted. So that's my fear. I mean, I haven't thought the thing through. One of the problems is we although these submissions were sent out yesterday, I only got mine this morning when I went into the office. But on the one hand, one wants to protect people, protect the vulnerable, but on the other hand, one wants to avoid harm where it gets maliciously used. So I don't know. That's the thing I'm throwing around in my own mind.
Okay.
So, Chair, if a person has good reason to be there, then it wouldn't be regarded as unreasonable. And surely, what is the time period for anticipating the return? Is it 24 hours? And if so, then, you know, maybe that should be 24 hours. So if there were such a situation where the person maybe doesn't disclose that they have good reason to be there, then they could deal with it within the space of a day or two.
Chairperson, also in addition to that, in clause 15, it's an offence for willfully making a false statement and also bringing a matter where it is vexatious as well. We did in our submissions have one or two people that were paranoid, schizophrenic, that felt that everyone was stalking and harassing them from someone to the SABC, monitoring them through the television, and you do get cases like that, but I would submit that those are really the exceptions to the rule.
The return date, I think it's 10 days, but you can be brought forward to the other person. You can anticipate the return back 24 hours notice to the other person, and of course you can anticipate the return date.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to address you on two aspects. The first one is on the entire issue of vulnerability. This is a necessary piece of legislation with a huge amount of unintended consequences. And one of them, I've seen this happening in the States. When I went in the States in the 80s, the population was strong. Then there was more and more of this legislation, and the entire population became meek. Everyone is afraid of saying anything to anyone for fear of getting sued or getting arrested. It is the measure of how much it is legislated how human relationships should be around. When I went to the States in the early 80s, in the late 70s, people could still pass a remark on female beauty. Now nobody dares doing that. There is no mention. Somebody can come with the most outrageous conduct or dress, and societally is not acceptable to remark that. It's a process which transforms the entire population into something which is much more meek. It might be desirable, but by protecting the more vulnerable, the whole of society becomes much more dependent on legislated morality, on legislated social conduct parameters. And that's a concern to me. My neighbor is very upset about my barking dog. And the dog can bark under 6 minutes in terms of municipal law. The ordinance says 6 minutes, it's less than 6 minutes, it's fine. But my dog barks at night and she gets very upset. The criterion of harm is a subjective harm. It's psychological and mental harm. I don't know what the difference between psychological and mental is. I'm sure I've been enlightened that it's psychological and mental harm. So my neighbor has harm from my dog. She will go to court, and these are the type of people who will use this legislation. I mean, people who have, don't need to be protected. I mean, I receive a huge amount of harassment every day from everyone, and I won't use this legislation. There is a certain type of people who will not use it. So we are empowering people who are often borderline, over and above of those who require actual legislation. So we need to be careful. And that's my first consideration. My second consideration, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm very distressed. I feel seriously harassed because we are presented with a 5-page bill on harassment and a 5-page bill on amendments to the civil procedure, to the Criminal Procedure Act, which has got nothing to do with it. We amend bail laws, we amend witness rules, we made all sorts of things. And what's in the schedule is not consequential amendment. I'm all in favor of catching a fast train to put through legislation which is urgent, but I don't see any of the things in the schedule which is unrelated to the bill as being particularly urgent, and I think should be taken out of this bill and put on a criminal procedure amendment bill that we can consider separately.
I can probably respond to the last one first, Dr. Abbasini. One is allowed to make consequential amendments to other legislation in the bill. I think it's done regularly. But right, if you look at the amendment to the Domestic Violence Act, you will see that we incorporate into the Domestic Violence Act a procedure similar to amendments in the bill, where we actually make we make provision for the Domestic Violence Act and the ADA to also cater for the subpoenaing of witnesses. It's a serious omission in the Domestic Violence Act, and that is in par with the current Section 4 of the bill. We can wait till later, but I believe in order to protect vulnerable groups, it may be quite essential for the court to have that procedure available. It is a general trend nowadays that people do not want to testify in domestic violence cases, and this actually gives the court the power to ensure that the witnesses attend the proceedings. Also, if you look at the amendment to Section 384 of the Old Criminal Procedure Act, you will see that a similar procedure is inserted in the Criminal Procedure Act, the Section 384 of the Criminal Procedure Act, in the idea to provide for the court to subpoena witnesses. It's more or less in par with the procedure envisaged in Section 4 of the bill. However, since we're actually busy considering amendment to that in the bill, we also made provision or inserted certain other provisions or amended certain other provisions of Section 384, also to make it more user-friendly and more or less to expand its application ambit, also to protect persons who are in need of legal protection. Section 384 was a kind of interdict procedure that is utilized in magistrates' courts from time to time. Okay, that is the two main amendments that is affected in the schedule. Then further on, we also affected an amendment to certain bail conditions. We actually request that the views of the person who is the subject of a crime be taken into account. Due to the fact that we actually investigated harassment, that is one of the amendments that was a kind of result of the investigation, in that various people complained that the views of the person who is actually the victim of a crime is not taken into account. So to an extent you can at least relay it back to the main legislation that is introduced in Parliament.
Into the amendments of various acts. I mean, my concern with the DVA is that the Police Secretariat is currently has undertaken to do a comprehensive review of the Domestic Violence Act. And I'm just concerned if we're going to start making changes here, then it might conflict with what they're doing. And I may have raised this before, but I don't think you were here. So if you can perhaps deal with the Police Secretariat's office, please, and just see what progress they're making on that score. Now, the second point is, if you are proposing one of the changes to the Domestic Violence Act, would it not also be, I see in your other submission that there is a definition of harassment and stalking there, and it seems to be the opinion that that is unnecessary to have two separate definitions of harassment and stalking. Would it not be appropriate to bring those definitions now in line with harassment in terms of this bill?
Just for clarity, exactly. There are three things here. There is an amendment to the Domestic Violence Act, which is not consequential, but is related. There is an amendment to the Firearm Control Act, which is consequential, which is not consequential, but is related. And I don't have big problems with them being there. That's not the issue I raised. I raised the issue in respect to the amendment to the Criminal Procedures Act, which goes on for three pages, which is across the board, which is neither consequential nor related. It might be desirable, I'm not questioning that, but deals with witnesses, it deals with bail, and it's a different cattle of fish altogether.
We can look at that, but as I indicated in the beginning, I'll probably try to refer to the more necessary representations that were received by the department. I believe all the others is catered for in the submission. I can go through representation by representation, otherwise I can just more or less skip to the main concerns to the Act and try to deal with it from that angle. It depends. Do you want me to proceed? Okay, the following concern that was raised again by the media relates to Clause 5 of the Act. Clause 5 of the Act made provision for, Italia makes provision that the court may close proceedings in the idea that the identity of certain persons may not be made known. It's page 32, it starts there, page 32 of the submission. Clause 5 of the Act provides that the court may, if it's own accord or at the request of the complainant or related person, if it's of opinion that it would be in the interest of the administration of justice, that the proceedings in question be held behind closed doors direct that A, the public or any class thereof may not be present at those proceedings or any part thereof, the identity of or address of any person may not be revealed, or no information relating to the proceedings be published in any manner whatsoever. And where a witness under this Act is a child, the court may direct that no person other than the witness and his or her parent or guardian or person in loco parentis may be present at the proceedings, unless that person's presence is necessary in connection with the proceedings or that person is authorized by the court to be present. And then further on, it provides nothing in the section limit any other powers of the court to hear proceedings in camera or to exclude any person from attending those proceedings. Again, the presentation was received from ADVSA, and they claim that Clause 5 of the bill is considered as being problematic in that it failed to give proper effect to the principle of open justice recognized in the South African common law and the Constitution. It is submitted that a provision in Clause 5.1 of the bill, that the proceedings may be closed to the general public or any part thereof, that the person's identity may not be revealed, and that a court may order that no information concerning the proceedings might be published, while defensible in some instances, doesn't take due account of the principle of open justice. Clause 5 should be amended to allow interested parties to make submission to the court before the court orders that the proceedings should be closed, that the identity of the person should not be disclosed, or that information concerning the proceedings should not be published, or alternatively, once closure or reporting restrictions has come to his or her attention. And they proposed the amendment then, which is contained on page 33. Our response to that is is that although not directly stated, I believe it just, again, it's a concern of the media that they are actually being blocked from certain proceedings, and that they may not be able to report on proceedings. Okay, as a general rule, we accept that proceedings should be open. We can look at the Constitution, Section 34, 35(3), which require that a court proceedings in the country must be in public. You can also look at all the authorities I referred to. But then I also refer the committee to various enactments on the statute book that expressly provide that proceedings may, under certain circumstances, not take place in an open court. In this regard, we can look at Section 153 of the Criminal Procedure Act, Section 52 of the Magistrates Courts Act, also Section 56 of the Children's Act. And there's various enactments on the statute book that prohibits the publication of certain information relating to court proceedings. One can refer to Section 154 of the Criminal Procedure Act. But of particular interest is that the open trial principle was dealt with as follows in Stout versus McQuinna, where the court came to the conclusion that it is a constitutional imperative that a criminal trial should be held in open court. However, in the judgment of the court, it was also accepted that vulnerable witnesses must be protected from public exposure, because exposure may endanger their lives or safety because of discomfort or embarrassment to testify before an audience. The court found this to be particularly true in matters of trauma, sexually sensitive matters, where the witness may be exposed to emotional or psychological harm, and it is admitted that the same principles should apply to proceedings in terms of the bill. The role of the importance of the media in open democratic society has been affirmed in Kamala versus Shlomisha, and I quote the the relevant paragraph there. But I also want to refer you to the judgment of Independent Newspapers versus Minister for Intelligence Services. It's a 2008 Constitutional Court case where the following was said: I am, however, unable to agree with the submission that the restriction placed on public access to proceedings is only permissible in exceptional occurrences, and that a party seeking to restrict the court, the court bears a true onus of demonstrating that the restriction is justifiable. The logic consequence of this stance is that all court records may not be restricted, except in exceptional circumstances by a court order after a formal application. On notice to interested parties and after hearing in an open court. In other words, I accept that the default position is one of openness. My difficulty arises in defining the circumstances in which the default position does not apply. As will become apparent later, I cannot accept the argument that the default position may only be disturbed in exceptional circumstances. The exceptional circumstances standard advance is inconsistent with the design of our constitution and the jurisprudence of this court on several counts. The better approach, I think, is to recognize that a cluster of rights that enjoins open justice derives from the Bill of Rights, and that important as these rights are individually and collectively, like all entrenched rights, they are not absolute. They may be limited by law of general application, provided the limitation is reasonable and justifiable. It is not uncommon that legislation and the common law in this country and elsewhere in open and democratic societies limit open court hearings with fair trial rights or dignities or right of a child or right of other vulnerable groups are implicated. You can also look at Director of Public Prosecutions.
My worry is that the Avusa concern wasn't around the onus or the reasons or anything like that. What they are wanting is simply is effectively procedural. So they're not trying to argue exceptional circumstances as the reason that courts can be closed. As far as I can see it, all they are doing is setting out a procedure that allows them to be heard. The presiding officer may consider. Now, you could argue that is already there. People have that right. In which case, but the difficulty would be, this is, as I said earlier, magistrate's court, who may not be particularly clear on the niceties of the law. And in any event, is what is here actually adding much to the existing law? Is there any harm in putting it in? But they're not, I think your response is around the merits of allowing a case to be closed or not, whereas their argument is not on the merits, it's on a procedural issue, the opportunity to make representations.
Mr. Jeffrey, if I, the first part of our representation relates to that, but we also point out later towards the end that there are certain difficulties if you implement a procedure where a third party can actually approach the court in proceedings like this to request inter alia access to proceedings. Firstly, the whole bill was actually intended to be expeditious remedy to a person. In many instances, this will then relate to court proceedings, pre-hearings to the trial that probably will last much longer than the actual harassment hearing itself. Furthermore, it's our belief that during this pre-trial applications, it actually leaves a room open a room open that the complainant in this instance may be subjected to secondary victimization. Into area that obviously she has to put certain facts before the court and will most probably and maybe cross-examined on that fact. While I don't think it was the actual intention to actually allow her to undergo such or to be the hands of the other party.
I don't understand that. I mean, it's basically that it's not about cross-examining the complainant. It's around an opportunity for interested parties to argue that they could be present. The decision then is with the court, and they can apply all these constitutional court judgments that you've referred us to. But it's basically an opportunity that they be present and to publish the identity of the persons, of any person involved in the proceedings.
Can I manage 15 so I can get the benefit of an additional question and answer them together? May I, Mr. Chairman? Thank you. Now, the two-part answers you gave, the third party coming in, here the issue is whether or not they have an interest. And there is no problem with third party entering a litigation. There are lots of opportunities for them to do so by intervention. So I don't have a problem with that. Additional lengthening the procedure, you're absolutely right. It will happen. But when will it happen? It will happen in a case in a million. Or a case in 10,000, when there is a public interest, they're not going to go after when my neighbor, they will not object when my neighbor intervenes. So there are two levels of things. They must be such that the court is about to close it. So special case. And there must be a public interest which justifies them to bother to go to court. And what I would suggest doing in a situation like this is to introduce a criterion of reasonableness. So let the court do the balancing of interest. If they need to do the balance of interest on the reasonableness of the conduct, they can perform in the same context a much simpler assessment and balance the interest of the affected party to their privacy against the public interest. So So I think we should make provision for that. I agree with the Honorable Jeffrey. I can probably just...
Can I just finish by asking this question? The provisions under 2, that the court may consider oral or written submissions by any interested party in considering whether to close the hearings, and any person may apply to court for an order that they be present at the proceedings. Are those two provisions actually not already allowed in our law? So you have this harassment order hearing. The media then hear about it and they make an application to, one, be heard, to be able to produce any evidence that they should be allowed to be allowed in, and two, that they should be allowed to be present. Have they not got the right to do that already?
Well, Mr. Jeffrey, I'll refer you to Clause 5.1, where we say a court may, firstly, out of its own accord, or the request of a complainant or a related person, if it's of the opinion that it would be in the interest of the administration of justice. I believe in order to determine when it's in the administration of justice, I think it is like that, that the court will probably have to evaluate arguments and the application team in some instances. So I think it's debatable, but I think yes, they have the right to apply to court.
So then is this actually adding anything different? Is it not just making it easier for a magistrate to see this procedure in the Act?
Okay.
So that's all it's doing, is it's just making a judge, might not be necessary, but a magistrate, it and I hope I'm going to really be, next time I have a traffic fine, I'm going to be really in serious trouble. But from a magistrate's point of view, it then just sets it out so that they don't get it wrong.
I think our next presentation actually deals with electronic stalking. This relates to the definition of harassment by electronic means, is that right? At the bottom of the last point of the document, but there was also certain other submissions that is taken up into the document itself.
Are you not also referring us to your little two-page thing, probably need to define the following?
I'll discuss that later when I discuss that. Okay, first, I can probably browse through your document at page 14, Women's Net. Actually wanted to know if electronic surveillance is included in the definition of harassment. And yes, we said it is. Watching in the definition refers to the surveillance that is intended in the representation. And then at page 26 is where WomenNet actually said that where a person is actually arrested via electronic media, the identity of the harasser will never be known. I can probably refer to the last paragraph or the last point of discussion in the summary, where
Commissioner of General Equality also point out that electronic harassment is not adequately dealt with in the bill. Harassment through electronic media usually takes place through electronic communication service provider on his network. Information is sent over to the complainant as one kind of harassment, but it was also pointed out to us that in certain circumstances, information about a person may be distributed to other persons without the complainant actually, without the harassing media actually coming to the attention of the complainant. Okay, firstly, if we deal with cyber stalking or harassment, in most instances, the big problem is that the identity of a person will be unknown. A person can never be traced. Although the service providers will actually can trace the person, but they will never make that information available to the person himself. So currently there's two pieces of legislation that deals with the revealing of identity of cyber stalkers. That will be Section 205 of the Criminal Procedure Act. But Section 205 of the Criminal Procedure Act is only applicable to criminal proceedings. The other one is obviously RICA. RICA will not assist the person in that. It relates to interception of communication in the where there's a serious offence involved. So what we need to do here is more or less to make provision for alternative procedures through which the identity of a person can be ascertained. And this can be done, and I believe must be done, during the initial application process for protection order. It's usually at that stage when the identity of the cyber stalker comes to the fore, and the court, I don't think it will serve a purpose if the court issue a protection order and it cannot be served on the person. So we did draft an amendment, that is the two-page document that is distributed with the other documents. We actually try to cater for this procedure. The first thing is, communications usually originate from, let's call it the telephone number. In terms of RICA, electronic communication service providers must, in terms of Section 39-40 of the Act, inter alia store a person's identity number, name, surname, and address. And they must store it on the system for a long period. Due to the fact that information is thus already available on the systems of electronic communication service providers, we can actually, by way of a procedure in terms of this Act, request them to provide to the court this information, thus identifying the harasser. However, certain logistical problems. It's like the court usually needs this information quite quickly. So in the proposed amendment, we provide that this information must be brought to the attention of the court within 96 hours. Another further problem is that the storing facilities of the service providers may be located quite a distance from a service provider, and we do not foresee that they will in each and every case be able to drive cross-country, let's say to the Northern Cape from Johannesburg, to actually submit the affidavit to the court. So we intend, or we propose, that provision thus be made that the court may actually order an electronic communication service provider to provide this information to the court, that this information or this order of the court be served on such an electronic communication service provider by inter alia the clerk of the court, a sheriff or a peace officer in a prescribed manner. We can't prescribe a specific way how this can be done, and that the service provider then in a prescribed manner furnish to the court the requested information by way of an affidavit in a prescribed form. And then, if the court do get this information and the so-called fire stalker can be identified, that the court then proceed with proceedings in terms of Clause 3.2 of the Bill, and the court may, in certain circumstances, then issue such a protection order against the cyber harasser. This is just a proposal, obviously. This comes from the department.
Mine is not so much on what we've been presented, but it's... Oh, sorry.
No, I'm having terrible stomachache with this one, Mr. Chairman. This is wow, wow, wow. Setting aside all the prescribed here, prescribed there, and prescribed elsewhere, which force us to accept something that we haven't seen. We are engaged in drafting legislation on the protection of personal information. And all that gets protected in the one bill, and then it must be, apology about this, must be disclosed if somebody goes to court on an ex parte communication, on an ex parte application, on allegations of harassment. I mean, there are all sorts of mechanisms in place to protect identities. I mean, whenever we open a website, you click for a proxy and you need to give the information, and they have the information, but the information of who is the owner of the website is generally not available. The same thing with respect to your email address, which is the correspondent of what in the old days used to have an unlisted phone number. And some people have an unlisted phone number. And all it takes is for somebody to go on an ex-party and make allegations that you're using those addresses to get around the protection of privacy. My immediate reaction is still terribly uncomfortable.
Yeah, mine isn't so much the procedure for, this is about getting the identity of the person. Mine is more that the issue that came up in the hearings, that cyber stalking is not really covered. And the argument, if I remember it correctly, from the department or the law commission was, oh well, technology is advancing so much that you don't want to describe what cyber stalking is because it may be different in a few years' time. But be that as it may, and they I think felt that under the definition of harassment, that cyber stalking could be covered under the definition of harassment. Now, my concern is I don't think it is particularly clear. I'm not a cyber expert, but I think it would be things like you have a Facebook page. And somebody comes in and keeps writing things on your Facebook page, on your notice board, or you're in a chat room, and somebody perpetually comes in there and says derogatory things about you, which is not, which may be engaged in electronic communication aimed at the complainant. It may be loitering. But it's a bit unclear whether it is, and I don't think have you responded to that at all? And shouldn't that then be something that my understanding is you were going to respond to that? That was a valid issue. And that would be then more under the definition of harassment. So it's a different issue. But maybe if we can just leave it there, unless anybody else has got something to say on this point, but please. look at the effective coverage of cyber stalking.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to, for the benefit of the Honourable Jeffrey, if you've got somebody putting things on your Facebook wall, then you unfriend them and they can't do it anymore. But my concern is Dr. Ambrosini is uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable with the fact that people are allowed to remain anonymous and not be cased while they're busy harassing people. And surely the issue would be, the court has to be of the opinion that the protection order should be issued as a result of harassment. So obviously they would have to ensure that that is harassing. You can't just go to court on ex parte and say, well, sorry, I think so-and-so is harassing me. I mean, they've got to show proof that the person is harassing them and that they are receiving emails or phone calls or SMS from a particular number or a particular address. And I would, I do agree we need to be careful, and I would like to know what the legal advisor's opinion is as to how this fits in with the Protection of Information Bill. Because we obviously do want to, restrict people's privacy as little as possible. But if they are committing acts that are harassing people or criminal acts, then I think we need to, that comes in with the balancing of rights again. But I would like to know, what is your view on how does this fit in with the Protection of Information?
Just also abuse my authority a little bit. What informed you that it should be a 96 hours time frame, firstly? I'm a little worried about this prescribed form, and because in another committee that I served on, I dealt a lot with this electronic communication service providers. And they have means of getting you this information literally like that, but I understand the court's position, which is a little different. I tend to also agree with Ms. Schaefer. Don't agree with Dr. Ambrosini's views that, if someone is stalking or harassing someone, then that person's identity should be made known to the court. And if the court orders it, then so be it. Bearing in mind, of course, the Jules High situation, where the website was based in Russia. But I'm still of the view that something could have been done there. I don't think the service providers were being absolutely upfront and honest about it. I think they just shrugged their shoulders and said, well, what can we do? I'm of the firm belief that something could have been done. But Mr. Roberts, if you could just address us on some of the issues that have been raised.
If I can just add something. Mr. Turner, my understanding of this type of legislation is that it's about getting an order which says stop beating your wife. When issuing that order, whether or not you're beating your wife in fact is not relevant. If you're not beating your wife, fine, the order doesn't affect you. If you're beating your wife, you need to stop. So if it's an ex-party, you can go there and make an allegation of somebody doing something that you should not be doing, and if he does do it, stop. If he doesn't, it's not affected by it. And that's why there is ex-party. There is no downside for not having heard the other side. And there is never somebody who is harassing. There is only one person who says that the other person is harassing. The other person has not been heard. There is one party stories. And as we all know, whatever goes to court, whatever goes in is not necessarily the truth. Especially in situations like this, which can be highly emotionally charged. So it's all fine for as long as you don't take away anything from the other person who has not been heard. But here we have a situation which something has been taken away from that person who has not been heard. We violate a right to privacy on the assumption that what went in, what the allegation was done, was correct. And that's my uneasiness. It goes against the matrix of an ex parte.
Thank you.
sorry, Chairperson. I don't really understand what Dr. Ambrosini says about this. I really don't understand it. What has been taken from the complainant, from the respondent?
The protection of privacy. If the you set up things to protect your privacy, and I want to find out, and especially in the cyber world, everyone is a pseudonym, and under the pseudonym, you express your political views, you express all sorts of things, you buy stuff. You've got your eBay account, your in Twitter and comments, and you look at this guy and says, "That bastard! I really want to find out who he is. I don't agree with his political views. I want to find out who he is." The simplest way is to go for an ex parte, alleging that this person is harassing you. And that person who has been so careful in protecting his cyber identity will be stripped of the cloth of his protecting his cyber identity in a context in which he did not have an opportunity of challenging the allegation. The privacy of cyber identity is very important.
That's it. Now I understand what he's saying, but there is that anticipation now. He may anticipate if he feels that he is unfair against him. He may anticipate before the 96 days they have suggested in this bill. He may anticipate it.
At that point is done, and this is the circularity of this difficulty, that the only way he can give an order against that person is by knowing who he is. And at that point, the damage is done. The identity has been revealed. And what if it turns out that this person was not being harassing anyone? Then he did not have an opportunity to be heard, no audio alter and partem, and his identity has been revealed.
Yeah, I mean, presumably if you're going to allege cyber harassment, you would need to produce evidence of it, which would be printouts of the email or the stuff on the. I mean, look, I would imagine the type of person. Let's say you've got some kind of discussion forum, in which people are discussing. People usually are in those fora with other identities. I think that's the kind of case Dr. Ambrosini is referring to. You'd have to basically allege that something was particularly targeted at the complainant, okay, which was threatening. If the respondent is busy sending you emails, well then, why send somebody emails if you don't want your identity to, if you're that concerned about your identity? I mean, that's more of a direct contact, interaction with somebody. But as far as a discussion forum, you'd have to show that this person, so it's not just some arbitrary, innocent, it's not Dr. Ambrosini under his cyber persona who's engaging in legitimate debate, albeit with some reactionary or right-wing views that he doesn't want attributed to him. But you know, that person has gone beyond that to actually target the complainant, and the complainant would have to feel that it's aimed at them, presumably. So I doubt if it would happen, is the point I'm really making. But I don't know, that's just my initial view.
Then, Mr. Chairman, if I may, we need to have a higher standard in this case. It cannot just be on the basis of the complainant saying so. There must be an element of independent third-party corroboration. If we are going into stripping somebody of something which to that person is valuable, it cannot be on the basis of a single affidavit, on the basis of the applicant saying so, but also situation. Let me give you, since we are arguing by way of examples, which I think it's a terrible way of drafting legislation, but let's do it. I'm guilty. But let's assume husband and wife, husband or girlfriend uses a pseudonym to do things that a wife or girlfriend is not particularly fond of, entertain correspondence with another woman, buying sex toys, purchase other things that he doesn't want, whatever he does. Wife wants to find out the identity of this person and wants to prove that he's actually doing it and wants to get into the account, etc. All that she needs to do is to go to court, claim harassment from the cyber identity, and there the cyber identity falls, and behind the person is exposed without her having had no other harm than the concealment of somebody else's identity. So it's cyber identities are precious.
No, I mean, I think now we're getting to some, with respect, sensible solution. I mean, there's no way we can approve something that says that somebody's got the right to privacy no matter what, and they can carry on harassing people and not be identical. But I do agree with Mr. Ambertini that there should be some kind of more proof than just one person saying so. And perhaps we could incorporate something like that in the bill, that there must be some kind of, they must show SMSs or print out of the SMSs or emails or whatever. If we can put that in, I agree with that. I mean, we must protect as far as possible. But if people are contravening, then they should have the right to be, they should forfeit their right to have their privacy retained.
Probably just respond to this, Dr. Albersini's, what he said. Okay, firstly, I think the bill as such has provided for that if you actually instigate proceedings as vexatiously, there's always the possibility that you may be punished with a cost order against you as such. Furthermore, a person that like as in all criminal cases, if you make an affidavit that is false, it's a criminal offence, and you can be prosecuted for that. The problem with corroboration as such of things that is sent around in the cyber world is that almost anything that you want to produce can be prefabricated. It's the same as all instrument of writing. You can forge almost anything. It's the same as what you can do on paper. So it may be problematic to provide corroboration in that regard. And I believe if the court is actually considering application for harassment in this regard, and you allege that the person has harassed you via the electronic wall, the court will, in considering the case, obviously want to have access to the information as such. I think any reasonable court will do that. I believe in defamation cases where you actually institute civil proceedings as a result of defamatory words against you that, on a website, I think the court will take into account that or want to see the web page where that words appear. So as such, I do not think it's actually necessary to provide for corroboration due to the fact that I think a court will, in any event, want that information and see it for itself. Regarding the 96 hours inter alia that is required in the proposed draft is that most of this information of a person is usually stored as a kind of archived information. If you want to obtain certain information of a person, they will probably want to link a message to the information of a person, and I believe currently it takes around about 3 to 4 days to retrieve all that information from the storage facility. That is why we actually provide it for 96 hours. Regarding the mentioning, well, there's a lot of prescribed procedures implied in this legislation. The big problem is we're working with something that is procedural in nature. I believe the Act already spells out what needs to be done, that draft. So we need to devise certain procedures now to give effect to the proposed amendment. And I believe if you look at past legislation, procedural matters is usually dealt with by means of subordinate legislation due to the fact that it can be amended if there's a problem, if it doesn't work in practice, if you want to beef it up or scale it down, it can be done quickly. You don't need to go back to Parliament each and every time, like if you want to amend a piece of legislation. The prescribed procedures provided for in the proposed amendment relates more or less to the manner in which this information must be submitted into the area to a court of law via the service providers. And there's also something like a affidavit in a prescribed form. That is just help to cater for and make the process easier and to overcome practical difficulties that we might experience if we want to implement it. Relating to cyber stalking, as Jeffrey pointed out, we can probably try to look at extending the definition of harassment to specifically provide for cyber stalking. But again, cyber stalking is nothing other than ordinary actions over a line. If you look at how it's done, if it's done via voice or over a telephone or via the internet, it's the same. It's just a different medium that is used to get to a certain result. And I think as such, according to us, harassment as such include all ways how you can stalk a person, irrespective of what method of what media you use to do that.
I'm not convinced, I'm afraid. I mean, you specify verbal, electronic, or any other communication. You specify electronic. I think it would be useful. I don't know what other jurisdictions do, but I think it would be useful to see that. And then just on Dr. Ambrosini's point, I mean, I know it would lengthen the procedure, but would it be of any value if there's a requirement that the electronic communication service licensee must notify the person that they're going to release their identity and give them like 24 hours notice or something like that. That then gives them the opportunity in this sort of unlikely scenario but basically what it is then an opportunity for them to then take action to try and stop their identity being known by approaching the court and things like that.
Consider that.
I mean, maybe we must leave this for when we deliberate formally, but I mean, I'm also not convinced by this saying that the court should, will probably take into account all these kinds of things. I mean, they probably should, but if they don't, then what? And it is very easy for people to make allegations, to say so-and-so is harassing me. I think we should include something more concrete, to say even if the court is of your opinion based on written proof or something, or some kind of, I don't know what the word is, but I don't think we can just leave it to make people say so is sufficient proof.
We'll look at it, so we come back with a redraft then.
We're then going on to the sort of belts and braces. Earlier I was being, I think Ms. Schaefer wasn't that sympathetic when I was fairly negative about magistrates. But I would have thought that, in this case, I would have thought they should ask, but maybe then this requirement of giving the respondent the opportunity to, this is now about protecting their identity, the respondent the opportunity to respond may then take care of that, so one doesn't have to then go for belts and braces scenario. No, but this is about trying to get the identity of the respondent. The electronic service provider is going to give their name, their details, so they get notified 24 hours, 48 hours beforehand that this is going to happen. They have the opportunity to make to approach the court. Send the lawyer, obviously, because.
Good morning, sir. I came simply to congratulate you on your elevation and to express my
gratitude out here. Chairperson, I believe that is the major issues that we addressed, but in relation to the presentations that was received in the committee. The committee also asked certain questions about the bill.
Just on the issue of the identity, okay, cyber, I remember there was a submission, and I don't know if you've covered it, of a requirement on the, say a person is being physically stalked by a real-time stalked or whatever, by somebody, they don't know who it is, but this person keeps lurking around, taking pictures of them, etc. I thought there was a submission that there should be an onus on the police to assist. Trace the identity of that person.
Yes, there was that submission.
Yeah, and what was the response on that? I suppose the issue is, manpower, but at the same time, the bill becomes, if you've got this arbitrary person who keeps following you and you really think there's harm and stuff like that, how does one strike a balance, really?
Can
you respond to that anyway, because I'm referring to the page.
Can I refer to the, I know what I responded to, it's more or less inter alia that, like you said, the police haven't got enough manpower to police or to look for information in this regard. Furthermore, the whole nature of this proceedings is civil in nature, and we do not want the police to be involved. In any case, it's one of the constitutional imperatives to investigate crime on the one hand, and not to meddle in civil affairs. If this harassment, however, amounts to a crime, then the police will investigate it and must investigate it after a criminal charge has been laid at the police station. That is how they will become involved, and through which you can probably ascertain the harasser's identity once he has committed a crime. But in all other matters that doesn't amount to a crime, we feel that the police should not become involved.
Just on the point Dr. Ambrosini doesn't like when he's off his phone in a committee meeting, the case then of a woman who has this man lurking around the whole time, she sees him, she's able in fact to take a photograph of him from her cell phone, she's just not going to get assisted. She doesn't know who it is. There's no obligation. There's no crime that has been committed because harassment is not a crime. Okay, as in the other jurisdictions. There's no crime that's been committed. She's just got to put up with it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the bottom line is, it's like all other civil litigation. If you do not
have the information of the other party, you will not be able to successfully litigate against them. The problem is that...
Sorry, look, this is about harassment, okay?
Yeah.
This is a specific remedy. I think those circumstances are not unusual. So I really don't buy the thing of well, there's just absolutely nothing that can be done. I mean, there could be a requirement on the police to take reasonable steps to try and find the identity of the person, so they don't have to spend days searching. But if it's very easy, then if it's a question of here's a photograph, look the person up on their facial database if they've got one. But I just think that's a huge gap that's not covered.
I don't know what happened.
Another issue that's worrying me, and I don't know if there is an answer to it because I don't think, you know, we have jurisdiction, but what happens if somebody's being cyber harassed and the service provider is outside South Africa, which is probably most of the time? Is there anything we can do? Nothing. We've got to rely on their law to enforce them to do anything. Have we got any international treaties or agreements or...
Well, I believe in some instances it might be possible for a court in Ireland, in terms of the proposed Clause 7, to actually issue an order to the effect that all internet service providers must block access to a specific site. Well, they can probably do that to an extent. It depends if all service providers work together in such an instance. I think generally you cannot, as a general rule, block access to the external site.
Mr. Chairman,
may I?
I mean, this is like that you were talking about child pornography law.
No,
pedophilia, yes, whatever. No, I was involved in the child pornography law, which kept being amended and amended and amended, and one does all the wrong things because for the right reasons. And this is another situation of doing all the wrong things for the right reason. Dare we not give any government, for whatever reason, good or bad reason, the power to stop access to the internet and force all the service provider to stop that, because once that mechanism is in place, which is not in place now, and it was trying to be put in place because of the child pornography, then it can be used for other purposes down the road. And one is only to look at China, what happens when those mechanisms are in place. The beauty of the internet is that the mechanisms to restrain it are not in place.
Honourable members, it's 1 minute to one. I had mentally decided we should stop for lunch at one and reconvene at two. Our schedule is that we continue until 4 p.m. this afternoon. So, can we then adjourn until 2 o'clock? Thank you. Yeah.